Okay, today is October 21st, 2013. We're doing Sefer Chinuch Mitzvot 349, and I don't know if we'll get to 356. We'll see.
that's a lot.
How far we're gonna. It seems like a lot, except for there's some themes here, so I wanted to kind of do themes because we're not going to go into all the details, as we said. So the first one's not part of the set. It's in between what we were learning before and what we're going to learn today, so we'll just quickly look at that one. So 349 is the prohibition against prostrating ourselves on a figured stone.
So, like an idol.
Well, no, that's prostrating yourself towards a stone. This is on a stone. Okay, so I don't know if you're aware, but on Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah, we sometimes for Aleinu bow all the way down to the floor, right? When people do that, they often have a little handkerchief or a paper towel or something that they put between their head and the floor. Have you ever seen that?
I'm not sure I've ever seen that.
That comes from this.
Oh. Okay.
So
to make
you're not allowed to put yourself on the on a stone floor. So in Israel, it's a real problem where they have the marble floors everywhere.
Right.
Here in our shuls, it's not. They're usually carpeted.
Right.
But
or wood or
something like that. Right. So
but
we sometimes we do
from.
It anyway, sort of here, just to like it's symbolic, just to like keep us in practice. But the idea is that outside of the temple, you're allowed to do it inside the Beit HaMikdash. But outside, you're not permitted because it is a way of idol worship to bow down towards a stone or on decorated stones or to place decorated stones on the floor in front of an idol and bow down on them. So we're careful not to do anything that smacks of idol worship, and this does.
But you could do it on a stone floor inside the Beit HaMikdash.
Inside the Beit HaMikdash, the stone floor is hewn, and you are permitted to do it there because it's inside the Beit HaMikdash.
So
everybody knows
everything you do.
You're not doing avodah zarah in the Beit HaMikdash.
Okay.
So because since this is in a way a mitzvah that's a fence, you're not. It's not actually bowing down to an idol. It's bowing down on something that is sometimes placed in front of an idol.
So, in
the Beit HaMikdash, everybody knows that's not what you're doing if you're bowing down in the Beit HaMikdash on the stone floor. So there you don't have to be careful of it. But it is from this, and I wonder if the Muslims get this too, why they use little carpets.
Maybe.
Because not just to create a prayer space, because it says here what you can do is have a pretty cloth. You can put down something like that. If a person prostrates himself on a pretty cloth, though there's no room, you're allowed to do that because there's no room there for suspicion. Hello, good morning. Where a cloth is something which rapidly wears away, and no human being would make it his god. Stone, however, is an enduring material, and it has, so this is interesting, it has a guardian angel in heaven. As the sages of blessed memory said in the Tractate Talmud Hulin, in one case he spoke to the mountain, in other case he spoke to the spirit of the mountain. So that's just a proof that there's such a thing as a guardian angel. So, for stone. So, when we say guardian angel, we should not be thinking American thoughts. It's so difficult to hear words like this in English and separate it from...
So what is the Hebrew?
So it really is, I think in the Hebrew it's a sar. Where did it go? So a sar here is the same word that we use for a minister, like sar habitachon, a governmental minister.
Oh, okay.
Which is a messenger, or not just a messenger, but somebody. How do you explain a sar in somebody who represents the government or can have the say or negotiate on behalf of the government, has been invested with that power? That's what a sar is. So a sar here is a type of a malach. So we've explained what a malach, an angel, is in the past. The mashal that I like to use, the parable, is a spiritual neurotransmitter, right? That thing that brings the thought, so to speak, of God into action. There's an agent in between the thought and the manifestation of that thought. So that's what a malach is for. They're charged for that. But there are certain things that have a sar, that have a spiritual energy that belongs to them, that represents them, that can, so to speak, and we don't believe this literally, this is figuratively, that can negotiate on their behalf. So sometimes when you'll hear a midrash about how God, let's say in the next class, right, where God talks to the moon can't talk, but it has a sar, or it has a malach, it has a spiritual energy that can be in conversation.
So are sar and malach synonymous? Not really.
I think sar would be a type of malach. Malach being the larger category, and then there's lots of types within it.
Okay.
And how does it differ from a shliach, like a messenger?
A shaliach for sure can be human also. It's just means a messenger. So really a malach could be a shaliach. But often we use shaliach, I think, much more on the human level. A shaliach. We often use it, we use it for somebody who, a shaliach mitzvah, somebody who does a mitzvah on behalf of somebody else. So a father is required to circumcise his son. But not all fathers know how to circumcise their son. So they will make the mo'el, the shaliach, for the mitzvah. But they have to charge them. They have to say, you're the shaliach for me. Please be the shaliach for me. And then we also look for shlichim on behalf of God. So we'll say, may the doctor be the right shaliach for you. Right? So we're not saying that doctor's going to heal you, because we know doctors can't heal. But doctors can channel healing. So we hope that that doctor is the right channel that you need for your healing. The healing comes from God. May that doctor be the right shaliach. So we give that bracha to people too. So that's it. It's a little different. It's a good question. Okay. Anyway, so that's basically this. And this applies, I believe, in all times. So all people, let's see. Okay, a person's not punished for this until they spread out their hands and feet like they would for a full prostration. So even what we do today is not considered that.
Right.
But still.
Without the spreading of the hands and the feet.
Right, it's not. It's interesting. We don't often see this. I meant to ask Rabiel about this expression at the very end of the mitzvah. Right, so as you know, but since some of you are relatively new, so the way that this book works is every mitzvah is first, the mitzvah is stated, and then the verse that it comes from is quoted, and then how you do the mitzvah, and then the roots of the mitzvah, so the philosophic principles underlying the mitzvah, and then after that, maybe some more details, and where you can find additional details, and which books you can find them, and then to whom it applies, in what time, and in what space, if the space is different, like if it's only applies in Israel or outside of Israel. So to whom it applies, in what time, in what space, and the punishment. That's just the order of each mitzvah. So here it says, the remaining details of the preceptor and the Talmud tractate Megillah. It's in effect in every place at every time for both man and woman. If a person violated this and bowed down on stones, prostrating himself with hands and feet outspread, he should receive whiplashes. Okay,
but happy
is he who keeps the mitzvah.
Yeah, I don't
that's rare
that.
To see that, right? I don't remember seeing that before.
I don't either.
So I thought that was very interesting. What does that mean exactly, and why did he put it here? Why isn't it after every single one of them?
What does the footnote say?
Right, expression based on Proverbs. Okay, so that just tells us where the expression comes
right.
from, but not why he put it there.
So I
found that interesting. Like, why was that there on this mitzvah and not on some other one?
And this seems like such a nothing one, really.
Right, yeah. So look what's up with that. So I don't know the answer. That's just a question. Okay, now we're going to start two separate subjects that are interwoven. In the next several mitzvahs, so from 350 to 356, we have two sets of mitzvahs. One is called arachim, or arachin. So I wrote that word for you on your paper. So you can write an N there also, M/N. It could be said in either way.
Arachin.
Arachin, or arachim. Right. Arach is the value of something. It's the same word, though, like we use in English for value, meaning something's valued at $100, but also we have values, we share values. The same way the word values is used in English, arachim or erech is used in Hebrew. It means both things. So, but in this case, we're talking about monetary value. So the mitzvah 350 is the precept of one who vows a person's valuation, that he should give his prescribed price. So this is not the value of a person, but the valuation of a person. So here the difference is not how much a person really is worth, just how much they're worth on the books. So men and women are worth different prices, and by age they're worth different prices. So and we don't differentiate between able-bodied and disabled, or older and weaker, or younger and stronger. In this, it's just straight up, there's a value for males, for females, and I think it's for below and above bar and bat mitzvah, so for grown and not grown, but not for
adult versus child, basically.
Yeah, yeah, basically that's it. So I want to look at these together. That's one. There's four mitzvahs about values, about evaluations, right? So 350, the precept that one who vows a person's evaluation, he should give his prescribed price. We'll talk about it in a minute. And then 353, the precept that one who vows an animal's valuation should give as the Kohen values it. 354, that if one vows the evaluation, I wrote evaluation here, but I think it's probably valuation. I just copied the book, but I think that's a typo in the book. That if one vows the evaluation of a house, he should give the Kohen's valuation plus a fifth. And 355, that if one vows a field's valuation, he should give that value set by scripture.
And then there's two that are stuck in the middle. How weird is that?
Yeah. And then there's two that are stuck in there. 351, the prohibition against exchanging animals consecrated for holy offerings. And 356, the prohibition against changing consecrated animals from one kind of offering to another.
And how weird is that? That those are right there in the middle of those others.
Right. So the whole thing, really, the reason why it's all together is because it's all talking about what you bring, the value of things, what you bring to the Beit HaMikdash, and how you give tzedakah. How do you give gifts to holiness, basically? That's the overarching theme, right? So that's what this is discussing. How do we give things to the Beit HaMikdash? This one, 350, is very long. Look how long this is.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Page 461 to page 475.
Wow.
So it's a very long mitzvah. There's lots of details. Which I don't want to get into all the details, because that's not what we're doing here, right? We are talking more hashkafa. So, but it's interesting to think about. I'm listening now to a series of on Sefer Chinuch on, I think it's on OUTorah.com or org, whatever it is. And Rabbi Rosner goes through every mitzvah, 20 minutes on every mitzvah, 22 minutes on every mitzvah. So if you want to hear more. Yeah, it is a long time. So especially Rabbi Rosner. He speaks quickly. He's a New Yorker for sure. I mean, where he's trained there. He speaks really quickly. But he's a real Talmud Chacham, unlike your teacher. So he brings different books and different ideas, and he explains the mitzvah, and then he has a section on lamdus and a section on hashkafa. So lamdus is the details of things, you know, like how it all works, and who asks the question on this, and so I'll give you an example of that as we go through here, but I'm not going to go through all. That's not what we do in this class, to compare different books and different Talmudic passages and how it works and why it works and all that stuff. It's not us. However, it is interesting a little bit to hear some of this. So here the concept, we want to just look at the root of this. So we're not going to look at how it all works, but on page 463, at the root of the precept lies the reason. So this is an interesting thing, right? So let's just, you'll see how it sounds disconnected and how we have to connect it, right? The giving the value of a person to temple service, right? That's what we're talking about. At the root of the precept lies the reason that a man becomes partner in the supernal realm in no other way but through speech. How is that connected, right? Right. This is the entire honorable, distinguished part of him. This is called in man the living spirit, as Unkelus renders it. There is a man in a speaking spirit. For all other parts of the body die and perish, but if a man should lose this good part, body will remain. Hi. Body will remain already dead as an instrument for which there is no desire. Therefore was he given the obligation to fulfill his word, his speech, which he uses for matters of heaven under all circumstances, for example, regarding consecrations and all matters of charity. Okay, so what does this mean?
I still don't
get
it.
Okay, good. That's what I'm here for. Okay, so what does this mean?
Good,
okay.
Good.
So basically, if we understand the Torah as the instruction manual, not on how to live a good life. That's not what it is, right? People say, you know, this is how you... It is, you get a good life if you follow the Torah. But really, the Torah is an instruction manual of how to use the physical to build your spiritual. That's what it is. What should you do in the physical realm to build yourself spiritually? So if we understand that a very significant way that we tap into the spiritual realm is through speech, and that's, in fact, what differentiates us as we are a type of an animal, but that differentiates us from all other animals is the fact that we can speak. But not just that we can speak, it's not just the power of speech, but what that means for us. How we communicate, how we transfer information, how we remember history, how we can dream into the future in ways that other animals have no access to. And that is what's transcendent about us, and that can, we can use that power to tap into the power of transcendence. So then the Torah, which wants to increase pathways for us to become spiritual, increases pathways for us to use our speech. Does that make sense so far?
So far, right.
So if the Torah wants to give us ways to grow through using physical, our physical selves, so it says, okay, I'm going to create a bunch of pathways for you to use your speech in different ways. Not only should you guard it from Lashon Hara, not only should you use it for prayer, not only should you use it for encouragement and words of kindness, but you can use it for tzedakah. So here's a way to use your speech for tzedakah. You can say out loud, I will give X amount of money. But there's a few different ways. You could say, I'll give $25. Or you could say, I'll give the value of Marlin.
Whoa.
That's what we're talking about.
Priceless.
Yeah. Right. So for sure it's priceless, which is why this mitzvah is, if you say a name of a person, you're not evaluating their value. It's just female, adult.
Oh,
this
okay.
is the amount.
Now I get it.
Right? That's
sort of
it. Oh. So I can say I'm going to give
Marlin
that value.
And an adult female is valued at
right,
X.
Right, right. And
well, that's
what I'm giving.
Kind of like an eye for an eye, the value of one eye, you know, monetarily
right.
damaged, you get back.
Right. Oh, so that's a great example, because let's say the eye was legally blind.
Mm-hmm.
Do you only get the value of a legally blind eye? I'm not sure. I don't know. That's Londis, right? That's not my area. But my thought is that an eye is worth an eye.
Mm-hmm.
That it's
whether
not.
Whether it's seeing or not.
Whether it's seeing or not.
It might be if it's blind.
Yeah, but it might not
legally blind.
Yeah, but if it's just like impaired. Like
right, that's why
I said
legally
like,
blind,
yeah.
not blind.
Yeah.
Yeah, it might be different if it's actually blind.
Yeah.
But an eye that needs, you know.
Correction,
a significant correction.
Is still an eye.
It's still an eye.
Well,
so,
think
right.
about it, it's true.
Right, it is still
on an equal playing field.
Yeah, so I think that's what's going on here. So there is a difference between...
So this all, I see sort of how this, that, in other words, a person might say that they would give tzedakah equal to...
Right, so you can say equal to a person. It's another pathway
to
use your speech to consecrate property for the sake of holiness. That's what it is.
And that's interesting. I mean, obviously, it's coming after the whole thing of slavery. Slaves and only slaves.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, it is. So, and this is in a set of four, because we have the animal's valuation. Now, the animal's valuation, as we'll see a little further down, that's why I put them all together. The animal's valuation, number 353, is the valuation that a Kohen values it. Now, so here you're not saying, I'll give the valuation of that cow. It's a little different mitzvah, because you can say, I'll give that cow. I can't say, I'll give Marlin. Or I can't say, I'll give my kid. You can't.
Right.
You can't give somebody else, or even
right.
yourself, really, who says you're appropriate for service in the Beit HaMikdash. You can't. You can just give your value.
But with an animal, you can't actually physically give that animal.
Mm-hmm. So what's with this? What's with 353 giving the value? So let's just look at 353, because look at the wording in it, which is interesting. The precept that one who vows an animal valuation should give it as the coin values it. But here, where does it say? Where does it say tummy? This is really as bad an animal that you can't give. Did say tummy here? Did it say tummy in the next one? No, that's an animal. Exchanges, not exchanges, but values. Well, anyway.
When this talks about animal's valuation, it does mean a kosher animal, right?
Right, so that's what I was going to say. It means two things. So let's say, there's two ways to give the value, right? You could say, I am giving money towards the upkeep of the temple. Right? So if it's money towards the upkeep, it's not an animal for an offering, then you can say the value of that pig, or I give that pig, and then they could sell that pig and use the money for the upkeep. Or you just give the value of it. So that's one possibility, that it's a tame animal. But here, tame also, from what I listened to, I don't see the word right here, but I'm sure it's in there because I read it before.
Well,
and
we talked about unclean animals.
Unclean, okay, thank you. So in this case, tame doesn't mean the pig or a camel or a rabbit. In this case, it means an animal that is tahor. You say, I'm going to give that cow, that sheep, that goat, and then you bring it to the Beit HaMikdash. And then something happens. It trips going up the stairs.
Right.
And now you can't offer
a gash,
it. Right. It gets a gash or whatever it is, and now it can't be offered, or another animal gores it or nibbles it or something like that. So it's no longer offerable.
Perfect.
It's
right.
Now not acceptable. Not that it's not perfect. It's in the realm of you can't offer it. So
in this case,
that animal is called tummy. So what do? You already consecrated it, and it can't be used.
So this is where they set the value.
So this is where the Kohen will set the value. So that's if it's a Baal Mum. So I just want to introduce you to these vocabulary words too. Baal being the same as like Baal Tshuva, mm-hmm. right? The master of, or it owns, right? So Baal Mum, if it has a blemish, then it can't be offered. It's called tummy. There's two types of mums, however. This is our lumdus section, the way that I do it, which is extremely lightly. Just giving you some vocabulary and a few extra details, right? So there's two types of mum. There's a mum kavua, a set mum, and there's a mum over, a passing mum, right? So we would use the word mum over, even in our yeshivish circles, we'd use this for, let's say, the ineptitude or immaturity of youth. You know, when a kid makes a stupid decision because they're a kid, you can say that's a mum over, right? It's a blemish. It'll pass with time. You know, we don't have to worry about that. And so I first heard that word actually after, I think when Avi was like 2 or 2.5, I got him a haircut and they cut off his payas completely. And I was so embarrassed to like walk around with my kid clearly with an anti-halachic haircut. I mentioned to my Rebbetzin Tila Yeager at the time, I'm like, look what they did, they cut off his pants. I'm so embarrassed. She said, it's a mum over. It's a blemish that will pass with time. Right? So that's how I learned the expression. But halachically it's an expression too, a mum over. Something that will pass with time, as opposed to a mum kavua, something set. Like if an animal has a thorn in its foot and so it's limping, that's a mum over. You take out the thorn, it heals, it's better, right? But if it, you know, I don't know, was injured somehow, that it's permanently limping, it broke its leg and now it's healed, but it limps permanently, that's a mum kavua, it's set, it's different. So if it's a mum over in the animal that you've already been, here's another word, makdish, sanctified, you've already set aside, you've been makdish it, it's got the root of the word kodesh in it, right? If you've been makdish an animal, and now it has a mum over, then you can just wait until the mum passes and you can still offer it. However, if it gets a mum kavua, then you have the kohen stand it up and say its value, and then you give that value.
Is it saying then that human beings are categorized, so it's a woman of a certain age is this value, but that animals...
Two different types of valuation. You can even do that with humans. You do that with, and we don't usually, but you could, certainly with slaves, selling a slave, you do, or even a Hebrew slave, right? Let's say somebody stole or borrowed money that they can't repay, and so they have to enter into servitude in order to earn the money to pay it back. So your servitude is only worth that, how much your work is worth. So let's say you're just the type that can wash dishes and sweep the floor, great. Let's say you have a special skill. You're a gem cutter, and the person who purchases your time, because they can't purchase your body, but purchases your time, has a gem factory. Right, you might be worth more
than the sweeper.
Than the sweeper, right? So, and it's also by the years, right? You get freed with the Shemitah year, so there's 3 years of your work. So you're a $60,000 a year person. That's a $20,000 a year person. There's 3 years left till Shemitah, and you owe $100,000. So then you only have to sell a year and a half of your time. right? So because it's valued more. So there is a valuation that way. It's not about the value of you as a human being, though. It's just the value of what you can offer monetarily. Mm-hmm. Right, so it's never about the value of a person. Because you can't put a value on that, right? Somebody is priceless. But with the animal, you can. It's just how much they would get, how much would they fetch in the market. You can put a price on them. Okay, and then we'll look at it inside, but just to see also that if one, so 354, that if one vows the evaluation of a house, he should give the Kohen's valuation plus a fifth. So that's an interesting thing.
Yeah,
who has ever had the tax assessor come to your house after you've done some improvements? Right? Mm-hmm. So you take them around the house to any room they want to see. But you're not necessarily opening the door to your newly finished basement bathroom. They don't need to see that you've made it really nice, or even that you have. It could be a closet. Like, you don't have to open the door and show them that you have a beautiful bathroom in the basement. They see your basement. It's mostly for storage. They don't even know, right? Fine. You're trying to, like, you want your house to have as low a value as possible when it's being assessed by the tax assessor. So if they say open the door, you're going to open it, but you're not going to say, oh, and look at my new bathroom. You don't do that, right? So apparently, once one has committed the amount of money that their house is worth, they might have done that during a tzedakah drive in the shul or whatever and said, oh, yes, I pledge the value of my house, right? Then the Gabbai Tzedakah calls them up a few days later
right over.
And says, okay, so the value of your house is, you know, what do you think the value is? And you're like, I think it's about $100,000, when really that's just because you're trying to value it as low as you possibly could. You're not going to lie, but within the market, it could be $100,000, it could be $120,000. So whatever you say is plus a fifth, because you're going to say low.
Right, right. They just know man's nature.
Yep, exactly. That's exactly what it is that the Torah is looking into the nature of man. We want to give, but once it comes down to actually forking it over, we want to keep it too. Mm-hmm. So the Torah helps us out by saying the valuation plus a fifth, that's what it is. So that you make sure you give the full valuation of it.
So I think this is an interesting thing. It says they don't have to do that for a field because you value your field so much you don't ever consecrate it for purchase.
But here there's a set value by scripture.
Because he cherishes it greatly since he bought it with his money. But why would a house be different?
I think houses today are so different than houses were then. Mm-hmm. We can't even compare.
I think the land was more valuable.
Yeah. Well, clearly. That's how you made your... Right.
Right. And land retains its value, whereas houses fall apart. It's just different than today. It's a lot is hard to figure out that kind of thing because we live such different lives, you know, with houses that are so vastly different. I mean, it's just fascinating to look at houses that are built in the last 20 years and houses that were built before that, just the size of closets. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, before China opened up, when clothes were expensive, closets were small. You know, and
people didn't have as much.
People didn't have as much, and they used to sell those little depilling things for sweaters. Who depills a sweater today? You just buy a new one. You know, like, people aren't taking that kind of care of their clothes. You listen to Dolly Parton's song. She has such a nice song about the coat of many colors that she was embarrassed because her mother patched her coat so many times.
Right.
It had patches everywhere.
Yeah.
But she learned to see that as love, that each patch was a patch of love. And my mother also felt that way. Like, she has a hard time with new things. Because she really feels like you wear something, you care for it. It's part of your life. It's one of your friends. You know, like, you don't just
go discarding
things, right? And you patch it. And every patch that's on it is a patch of investment, a patch of care, a patch of love. Not something to see as shame, but rather as you care for what serves you, and it takes care of you back. So there's this relationship with it. Yeah, that's not how we live today, sadly. Okay, so now let's look back. We can look at each one a little bit, but that's the general thought of the valuations. And the general concept is that we use our speech to consecrate in different ways. Because why do you need to say field? Why do you say animal? Why do you say tummy animal? Why do you say person? There's just different ways. Each one of them is a different pathway to use your speech to consecrate money towards holiness. You could just say money. But if you understand this wider concept that That we say after, usually after we learn in shul, we have this little mishnah that we say, Ratza HaKadosh Baruch Hu Lezakot Et Yisrael Lefikach Hirba Lehem Torah Mitzvot. So God wanted to give merit to the Jews, therefore he increased Torah and mitzvahs. What does that mean, right? So that's this concept. The more mitzvahs we do, the more it becomes a commandment. So then once it's a commandment, it is a pathway, a physical pathway to a spiritual destination. That's what a commandment is. So the more commandments there are, the more pathways there are to walk upon to increase your spiritual self. So you have lots of different ways. You could say, I'll give money. You could say, I'll give the valuation of a person. You could say, I'll give the valuation of my field. You could say, I'll give the valuation of my... There's lots of different ways. We need to be careful because these mitzvot apply today, right? Even though there's not a Beit Hamikdash.
Right, I was going to say there's no place, so...
We can still use our speech to give these types of gifts, so they would go to whatever holy institution, but we have to be careful not to say things that will get us into big trouble. And not to delay in giving them. Also, there's all kinds of things about delays. What is a delay? If you consecrate something or you make a commitment to give, how do you know when you've taken too long? You know, when is it delayed? Is it the next day? You know, that you didn't do it the next day? Look, that night, you should look. In our shul, we have a little thing of envelopes by the door when you exit. So if you made a pledge on Shabbos, right, I'm going to have this aliyah, and then you say, they give you a mishaberach, and you say, I'm giving $100. Right, so you're supposed to take an envelope as you walk out the door to remind you, put $100 in that envelope and give it back. You can't give it on Shabbos, but you should remember. Or if you're a guest and you were there, so our shul takes money to run. Please take an envelope and put something in it and send it back to us. So if you didn't do it, my husband's super careful. He does it that night. He really doesn't like it. If he goes to sleep and he owes the shul, you know, unless it's a planned thing like our pledge, that our membership that's divided out over the year. But if he makes a pledge on Shabbos, he likes to pay him with the Shabbos, like at least have the check written and so that it will, so that he doesn't, right? But when have you transgressed?
How long?
So it seems that 3 yantifs. Starting with Pesach.
So you have a little...
So if you went through Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkot, and you didn't pay, you've waited too long. But it's also, you should pay right away, just because you never know what will happen. We should never be hit by a bus or anything like that, but nobody wants to die with debt. Mm-hmm. Dying with debt is a very bad thing, so we want to pay our debts as quickly as possible, or make sure that they're well-known, let's say a house or a car, that kind of a debt, or medical debt even. Make sure they're well known so that they can come out of our estate so that it's very clear, so that our debts are paid. That it wouldn't be that we would die and have a debt that's unpaid. That's something that can really hold somebody back from spiritual elevation. There's all kinds of interesting stories of dreams that people have or they hear about debt so that they can make restitution for their loved one. But you have to have a certain amount of schus, a certain amount of merit to be able to come back to somebody in a dream to be able to say that so they can take care of it for you. Better you should take care of it. So better we try to be careful not to vow things that we don't do right away and be careful to make sure that we can do what we vow. Right?
I have a question. Mm-hmm. The first one, 349, when they talk about, you know, giving lashes, that concept bothers me.
So there are consequences for what we do. It's good that you're bringing that up. My husband also, especially I think in this year of mourning for both father and son, has been thinking more about punishment and what is that? God rewards and punishes. And that is one of the 13 principles of faith, is God's reward and punishment. So he's thinking, what punishment? How could it be that God just like, that there's a time when he just hits you with a 2x4 for the sake of hitting you with a 2x4? Like, isn't, like...
Not because you did.
Like, I hear that there's restitution, there's prodding you in a certain direction, there's getting you to think about things, there's expiation, removing negativity that you've incorporated into yourself, but punishment, that's just to hit you with a 2x4. There's no reason for that, except for that's the formula. You did wrong, you get hit. So I said, that's not my understanding. Like, I think you're confusing the English word with the Jewish concept. So it's not punishment. We say onish, but that's not what onish is. Onish is about putting you in the right direction or about taking away. It always has a constructive purpose. So it's always there to remove the negativity or push you in the right direction. So the idea is, how do we understand suffering in this world? Is it punishment? So there are. So we use the word punishment, it turns out, because it feels like punishment. We don't always see the bigger picture. And the classic example that's used is immunizations for children, right? So a child is petrified by the doctor who's coming there with the needle, right? And the mother is completely betraying the child by holding the squirming child down so that the doctor can wound them and cause them pain. That's what's happening.
How it feels.
That's what's happening from the child's perspective, right? Betrayal and injury on the respect on behalf of both the parent, ultimate betrayal, mm-hmm. and the physician that you're supposed to turn to for help, right? So that's what it is: betrayal and injury from the position of. But both the mother and the physician know this is good for you. We're doing this out of love. How hard is it to hold you down? But this is way better than polio. I want you to have this. Polio is the purple drops, but whatever, you know what I mean.
Used to be shot.
Right, tetanus. This is way better than tetanus. Lockjaw, and death from that. Better you should get this shot, which not only hurts when you get it, but for 3 full days afterwards, you're in a lot of pain, right? Every time your arm hurts, maybe you get a little fever. It always scared me when I would give my kids immunizations because you have to sign that form that says,
they may have get all these
maybe death.
You're like, really?
You know, it's like sore throat, fever, arm pain, redness, swelling, possibly death. Sign here. You know, like, but it is an act of love. Not getting into all the politics and health things if you're an anti-immunization person, but assuming that you believe that immunizations are good for the individual and our community. To help create that herd immunization, so that it really is an act of love.
But also, suffering isn't usually perpetual, and so when anybody who's been sick, after you've been sick, you realize how grateful you are to be well.
Yes and no. Some people die from it. Some people have long-term stuff. You know, mm-hmm. Some people are poor forever. You know, and just watch other people. You know, this was an interesting thing to me. I learned something about Lillian Hoffman yesterday. I went to one of the presentations. There were 3 presentations on Lillian Hoffman, Aleha HaShalom. She worked very hard on behalf of Soviet Jewry. So she was the valedictorian of her class in East High School. She was the first graduating class of East High School, and she was the valedictorian.
Wow.
And the valedictorian got a full scholarship to DU. But it was But it was during the Depression, and she was a girl. And girls didn't need a college education as much as boys. So it went to the second in the class who was a male. So she never got to go to college. And her whole life, she did feel bad that she never got a college education. She won it, and she didn't get it because she was a girl. So that is a type of perpetual suffering. You know, that won't be made up. You know, so there are things like that that are just like, they're there for you. And you're just going to suffer with it. You know, and every time somebody says, I graduated from whatever, you're going to be thinking,
could have been me.
But yet, had she gotten the education, she would not have been so proactive for Soviet Jewry.
Maybe, that's
she
true.
She was a main shaker in the community. I mean, she inspired so many of us to help bring Jews over from the Soviet Union.
Right.
Yeah, she was an amazing person.
Yeah, it was really interesting just to learn more about her and more about the movement. But she was so known by the Russians.
Oh, yeah.
That they tried to mess up his business. They tried to create union strikes.
Oh, he was in the liquor business.
He was in the liquor business. He had the biggest liquor store in the country.
At the time.
So the Russians, who were into the labor unions, right, because of all the communist thing and the affiliations, they tried to work through the unions to shut him down, to shut her down, because she was so vocal. So it's fascinating to see, like, what you could... So who knows what would happen? Right, so the question is... So, and that goes together, so we'll get to the lashes in a minute. But there can be suffering for the sake of what it brings out of you, and so you might still suffer. So that's the reason why we give that parable of the mother and the baby and the shot. The mother knows. God knows. He's our loving parent. It's our loving parent who wants us to have all good and knows much better than us what's going to bring out the best in us. So God may say, no, you're not getting that college education. I have different plans for you. And you feel the suffering. And yet, you're right, maybe it did bring that out. Okay, that being said, so there's lots of suffering like that. Sometimes you see it, sometimes you don't, sometimes you just feel it, whatever it is, right? And there is the need somehow, and I don't fully get how this works. I'm still working on the concept. I have to ask somebody because I know, let's just say, for instance, a Hitler. He has to be punished straight up. And we do have a concept of justice. And that justice, and just using him as an example, justice for him can't happen on this planet. He can't pay back. He can't make restitution for what he did. It's not possible. The damage is still unfolding today. Still today. You know, there's grandchildren, great-grandchildren of survivors that are still emotionally messed up because they were raised by a messed up family, right? Because they were messed up through that, right? So it's still unfolding today. The damage is still being done. So there, we do have an understanding that his soul will be cut off from eternity, but not until he pays every last drop of damage that he did. So somehow he is suffering enough to pay back for all the suffering. So there is something about suffering in the next world, because you can't do it in this world, that will pay back for whatever he did. So there is such a thing as punishment, but I don't understand how that works exactly. So
how does it really pay back?
It doesn't
exactly.
pay back.
Exactly, yeah, right.
It doesn't pay back. It's just, so it is, it's his restitution.
It's suffering,
right?
But it's not a payback.
It's not a payback.
It doesn't really help the people who are
no, it's not a payback, but yeah, there so is, but it does create yeah, a level of justice. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure. I don't yet
yeah,
fully get that.
That's a good question.
Didn't
we learn that there are certain souls, Hitler being one, and I think one of the, who was the one that, in the Bible, that will never have rectification. Never,
right.
Ever. Their soul will just be totally
right. Yes. So that's
it never existed.
Yes.
So why even bother with the suffering? I mean, for what purpose?
Right. That's yeah. what I'm saying. If we have the basic understanding that all suffering / what we call punishment
has
a purpose and is good for a person ultimately, because God is good and doesn't do things that are mean or bad. They might feel mean or bad, but they aren't mean or bad. If we know that, then my question is, how do we put Hitler's current suffering into that? Because his suffering, he deserves it, but it's not for his good.
Mm-hmm. And
it's not.
And
because after he finishes it,
victims yeah. either,
right? So. After he finishes it, then it's fade to black.
Yeah, he's not going to elevate.
You don't get to yeah. just die. I mean, that's what a lot of criminals think. You know, I'm going to shoot everybody up in the theater, and then I'll shoot myself because then I won't have to pay for what I did.
Right?
No, sorry, you still do. Yeah. You know?
Yeah, but we don't know. We have no clue as to what his suffering will manifest.
Right. So that's what I'm saying. I don't. I'm still yeah. right. Good. Right. That's good. So there's so what's important to know is there's a question mark. Not to say that doesn't make sense, that doesn't work, it can't be. Just to say, I don't know how this works.
We don't know.
This is an area of inquiry. Should I choose to pursue it? Or I could choose not to. But this is something I don't understand how it works. I do understand there's a concept of justice. I do understand there's a concept of suffering. I do understand that God is good. I don't understand how that all works together. I'm not quite sure yet. Right. Getting back to the lashes. There is a concept of retribution, but proactive and positive retribution that has to be taken from a person. So the Beit Din can do that for a person. So rather than having to get into a car accident, you could have lashes. Right? Today we don't have lashes, so we might have to get lashes in a different way. But there is some kind of consequence that comes. It's consequences. It's not necessarily punishment. Here it's listed as punishment, mm-hmm. but it's really consequences. If we don't brush our teeth, are we punished by cavities? Well, it costs a lot of money and it's really uncomfortable, yeah. right? You could call that, but that's the consequences of what we did, right? So it's up to us if we want to do it or not, right? When they say floss, just floss. The rule is floss just the teeth that you want to keep.
Uh-huh.
So, right? So, but if we don't and we lose a tooth, so is that a punishment? It's not. We understand that's the natural consequences. So that's the same thing in life. There are consequences. So, but the Beit Din can, in a way, assist you with the consequences in a way that's not as bad as maybe other ways might be. Our rabbi, Rabbi Avitan in Long Beach, Shalom HaShalom, he, before Yom Kippur, he would give lashes to the men.
Hmm.
Voluntarily, they would come. They would be soft. He would take off his belt, and he would hit them 39 times, like that.
Wow.
Yeah, not to cause welts or, like, you know, I don't think he
not
left
like
red.
Not like my father paddled me with his belt. Yeah. Not like that.
Not like that.
Those were consequences and punishment.
Yes, right. Exactly. Right, not like that. Right? It was, this is much
It was softer, symbolic.
Right? Yeah, this is symbolic, but he did it 39 times so that a person would be released, so that they would be yotze, so that they would have already received the punishment that they need to receive for any of these things that they did. So they don't need to get it in some other creative way. Hashem is very smart. He could do whatever he wants. We don't have a Beit Din today that's handing out lashes. No problem. There's car accidents. There's financial loss. There's house fires. There's contractors that lie to you. There's whatever it is. There's a lot of different ways. There's termites. There's, you know, all kinds of different ways Hashem could take care of whatever you did. So, yes, Hashem does take care of it. But it is out of kindness. Because somehow it does help remove from us the negativity that we've incorporated into ourselves. So the whole world is about how do we use the physical in order to access the spiritual, to grow the spiritual. If we can use the physical to grow spiritual, we can then also use it to diminish. Mm-hmm. So when we have done that, Hashem loves us enough to help us fix it up. Yeah, that's up to us.
So wait a minute. I'm troubled by something. How could an earthly court, as auspicious as the sages, the Beit Din, whatever, inflict mortal punishment that would absolve a soul?
Because God said.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
that's the halakha.
The power was given to them to do.
But that's, I mean, because of their lofty.
No, because that's the law.
That's the law.
That
might happen today.
That's what I'm saying. That's the law. What's the law? Halacha.
Right.
That's the way you walk in the physical to access the spiritual. That's what halacha means, right? So once Hashem creates a halachic pathway, you don't have to be the most elevated person. You don't have to be a navi and see into that person's aveira. If that person, so all this is a witness and warning.
So that's why it's all so clear. That's why there's not so much discretion.
Right.
That's why the rule is the way the rule is.
Right.
Because if you violate the rule, here's the consequences.
Right.
So you don't have the discretion to say, oh, but you know what? You're basically a really good person.
Right.
You've done a nice thing.
Exactly.
You're not going to have to get that punishment. Mm. It's very black and white.
Right.
So it makes it so that anybody can.
Right.
Impose it.
And this is why in general, and I know this is difficult, but I'm going to say it anyway, this is why in general women are not allowed to be judges.
Because we would look at the
other.
It does
not work for us.
Yeah.
Really doesn't.
Yeah,
really doesn't.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you mean he needs lashes for this? Blah, 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 blah. No. That's the rules.
And you know what? Maybe. Just
right.
Maybe that override isn't very important.
Right. So, okay. That being said, let's look at...
Women of the Senate are the ones who got the compromise through.
Okay. That being said, let's look at these last two things of the exchanges. Okay. So the precept of 351 and 356, the prohibition against exchanging animals consecrated for holy offerings. Isn't there a positive one, too? Yeah, three together. Okay, good, thank you. That if one exchanges an animal consecrated for an offering, both animals are consecrated. And 356, the prohibition against changing consecrated animals from one kind of offering to another. Okay, so you've now said that goat is going to the Beit HaMikdash. You can't now say, oh my gosh, I didn't realize that's a cashmere goat.
Valuable.
Whoops! I meant that goat.
I didn't mean that one. My children's favorite one.
Right, right. Exactly. So you can't switch it out. Once you said it, you can't switch it. Right? For good or for bad. Like, let's say you see it's limping. Right? Now you can't say, oh, I didn't mean to give a limping one. I meant to give a better one. It's going to be that one. You can't.
So now then you get back to the one about the value.
Right,
and you
right.
The value.
So that's the Isur, right? You're not permitted. So that's 351. You are not permitted. It's called Tmura. Not permitted with Tmura. It's flipping, switching. It's the same root, if anybody knows modern Hebrew, Lahamir Kesef, to exchange money. Lahamir Tmura, it's the same root of the word. So you're not allowed to do that. It's also in Yigdal, if anybody remembers this, right? Lo yachalifakel velo yamir dato. Right? So yamir is tmura. It's the same root of this word, to exchange, right? I was humming that the whole way here. So that's the prohibition against. So you're not permitted to do that. Let's say you did it.
Do it anyway.
Anyway. Now
both
animals. Both animals are consecrated.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so now here's the little bit of Lumdish section, right? How are they both consecrated? Where did the Kedusha come in each one? Did it come... right, so there's a machloket. Is it that the first one retains its initial Kedusha? Because you said this animal is Kadosh to the Beit HaMikdash, right? And now, since you blew it, the second animal is also Kadosh. Or does the Kedusha from the one actually flip to animal number two, but because of this mitzvah, there's a new Kedusha placed on animal one? Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. What difference does it make? It does make a difference if you do it again.
So the first time you do it?
So can you do it in a chain? Will it make all the animals consecrated in a chain or not?
I see, if you do right? that
so
again.
So it does make, there are halakhic implications of how, where it comes from. So that would be the whole lamdas section. How does it work? Where did the Kedusha come from? How did it transfer? What's the source of this? How does it work with that? And there's machlokas on this. There's disagreements on it. But let's see, I think in the end of 352, I think it actually says how the chinuch holds.
These are really pretty long.
Yeah, they are.
Mitzvot. I mean, not just that one that we noted was so long, but they're all pretty long.
Let's see. You have to treat them both as holy. Where does it say this too?
I just think that's maybe because it is offering, and that's the only way we really got, you know, left.
Oh, good. Let's just go with that for now, because that's how we do have to wrap up, and I do want to finish. The whole point of all this, all these mitzvahs, one of the big points of them, is to teach you how important your word is and how important kudshim is. You can't mess around with it. So when you give your word, you gave your word, number one. And number two, when something's holy, it's holy. Don't mess with it. You have to realize that it's an elevated status, and you can't just go flipping it around. And you can't flip around, number 356 either, from one kind of offering to another. You can't say, I give this goat for a korban todah, and now you want to give it for a different korban. Nope. You said it. You have to mean it. It doesn't even mean... Even if you didn't mean it when you said it, you meant it by saying it, and so that's it. Once the words come out of your mouth, the power of your words is so strong that it falls on that animal, and its status is set by your words, and you can't change it. So it's to help you understand the power of speech, which, again, is a distinguishing power of human beings, and the power of holiness, that we should have awe for that which is holy and that which we make holy. We can't just go switching things around. So if we say this is set aside, how might it affect us today? There's little bits and pieces. When people give you shliach mitzvah money, do you have to give that dollar bill?
Yes.
You are supposed to give that dollar bill. Yeah.
You can't like accumulate it all.
Well, I was told it. That, you know, once an offer is made, it has to go.
Right. That's here. It comes from here, right? So you should, unless you make a specific condition that, you know, I will be giving $20, not quite sure which 20 they will be at the time, you know, but, and they can be mixed in, or the person can give you the money and say, here's a dollar to give it the kotel. You can give it in shekel. You could give it in dollars. Right. It doesn't have to be this dollar.
So you should
do
that. So that you should do that when you give it to somebody.
Right, because you don't want somebody to then have that dollar bill and then they forgot, they spent it on an ice cream, and then they gave that dollar because there was, oh my gosh, I spent that dollar bill that Marlon gave me to go to Israel.
It's not the same.
I spent it on an Arctic, so now I'm going to give a dollar.
Not the same.
It's not the same. So you want to be careful with
then
that.
Then you have to give $2.
Yeah, you do, actually.
What does that say?
That's the animal.
You have to give $1.25. You have to give $1.20 because you have to give a fifth. You have to make restitution and give a fifth.
Oh,
you have to give $1.20. Yeah. Right, but you shouldn't have done that in the first place. Anyway, right. So that's what I want. So it was good. We did get through all this.
Great,
good. Yeah, because I wanted to give the conceptual thing.
We're nearly done.
Yeah, we're nearly done with this book.
Oh my gosh.
It's super exciting.
I missed this.
Yeah. So, good. So we will finish.
It's nice to see you. Are you going to join us?
We should hopefully finish up the book next time.
Okay, so after an hour.
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know.